Welcome to The Bear on the Ball. I am your host, Nick Webster, and thrilled to invite to the show today, Tom Beyer. Tom is the voice of football in Asia, especially in the country of Japan, where he's been based for the last 20, 30 years, living in the beautiful city of Tokyo. And Japan has a very dear and fond memory in my heart from, of course, the 2002 World Cup. And of course, Japanese football has been on the rise ever since. Tom Beyer, welcome to The Bear and the Ball.
Nick, it's an absolute pleasure to be here, and I'm really looking forward to this chat.
Well, let's start with you as a player, because I think a lot of the listeners on this show, young aspiring players, and you took the very bold and risky move, I think quite a few years ago. I'm looking at your Wikipedia page, 1986 to be precise, and moved to Japan to play with Hitachi SC in the Japanese J-League. What was that experience like, and why did you make that move?
Sure. First of all, it was actually pre-J-League. Our J-League started in 1993, so what was called the JFL, the Japan Football League. And it's a long story how I got involved in Japanese football, but the shorter version is that I grew up in New York, born in the city, but played soccer upstate at a community college, which during the 70s was a perennial powerhouse. We won back-to-back national championships. But the head coach of that team was a Hungarian by the name of George Vizvari, well, very well known in the United States soccer circles. He knew a coach over here that was the assistant to the national team coach, who was a Dutchman. And I got introduced to him, and he literally took me by the hand to Hitachi and brought me there to just train. And I wound up training and staying there and playing with them. And it was kind of a tough period, because back then there weren't a lot of foreigners that played in Japan, especially at this team. I was the first foreigner to ever stand on the pitch. Okay. And at the time, they didn't allow players, foreigners, to play on the first team games. So although I trained with the first team every training session, all of my official games were with the second team. And then I basically became, I was a mediocre player at best. And I had an injury as well, a groin injury. And I wound up leaving and hanging up the boots, so to speak. But I fell in love with Japan, and I decided to remain here. So I had to figure a way to feed myself.
So the playing career, the dream of strolling across the green beiges of world football, just, left behind. You decide to maybe go into coaching. What was the impetus behind wanting to be a coach?
Yeah, that's a great question too. When I was growing up in New York, I had a couple of mentors. Back in the day, and even today, as you know, in America, soccer camp business is massive. And when I was in high school, or even below, before that, might have been junior high school, I had the opportunity to work at some soccer camps. They were called the World Cup soccer camps. I don't even know if they exist anymore. But they would travel around and to places like Connecticut, Massachusetts. And I went there just kind of like as an apprentice. I wasn't a head coach, but I was an assistant to these coaches. And I remember there was such camaraderie during these camps. And that camp specifically brought in overseas coaches from England. English football has got such a strong tradition, such a strong culture. And I just loved just being around these coaches. So I always had that kind of bug when I was a young player to be involved with children and youth development in particular. And that really just kind of spilled over to, after I got done playing. Even when I was a player, I used to always try to involve and volunteer and do as much as I could for the team in the community. So that's where I kind of gravitated towards.
So what is it about coaching that sets you afire? Because obviously, I'm a coach myself, and there's definitely different motivators. But when you're young, I think back to myself when I was a young coach, I didn't really know my ass from my head. I enjoyed playing the game, but actually coaching. So where was the fire, and when did you kind of figure out, hey, I'm good at this, and this is what I want to do?
Yeah, I think it's when I transitioned to actually becoming a technical coach and focusing on technical skill development that I become really, really interested. And also, I think it probably stemmed from the fact that I didn't really have any coaching when I was a young kid. Probably the first time I really had a really good top coach was in my junior college years. We had kind of, you know, I had a high school coach and things like that, but they're more kind of like caretakers, I'd say. So I really got head over heels into it when I got involved in technical coaching. And there's a very interesting story many don't know. I got involved in technical, and I got interested in the work of Will Kerver, the Dutchman. And that was presented to me through my close friend, really consider him a big brother, but unfortunately passed away a few years ago, former England striker, Paul Mariner. So Paul was like a big brother to me, and Paul got me interested in that work. And subsequently, that's what I actually brought over to Japan. And that's really kind of where I've made my mark here in Japan, is focusing on technical skill development. So I really love it. And I was pretty good at it as well. So that was kind of a no-brainer for me. And the rest in Japan, I mean, that's what I'm well known for, is basically being a technical specialist.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Will Kerver and the technical skills, the platform that he's created. And that platform, you know, is now 30, 40 years old, and it's still so relevant. But I'm curious, a lot of the skills would have been stuff that probably no one ever taught you. And I can only, you know, I came to America in 86, 87, and, you know, there was no football on TV other than, you know, Toby Charles and Germany, and if you could find a game on the Spanish speaking station. So did you have a player that you looked up to, and where did this desire to become technically proficient come from?
Well, you know, back in the days when I was growing up and playing, I'm talking about in the early 70s and things, the big thing back then was juggling the ball. So I had a relationship with the ball. It was just kind of the wrong one. And in hindsight now, when I look back in hindsight, in my generation, players spent a ridiculous amount of time juggling all the time. So I was familiar with the ball. I knew the importance of the ball. I wish I had understood the importance of ball mastery instead, actually putting the ball on the ground. And I was always the best juggler as well. Wherever I went, I one time went to a park and hooked up on a tripod a camera, and I put some music on, and I juggled the ball. I think it was over 20,000 times. It took me 2 hours to do, taking breaks, putting it on the back of my neck. So that was the fun, you know, kept me interested playing. But yeah, ball mastery. Then I started really understanding, and I've had really different aha moments in my career. There's really a timeline where, and I'm still evolving, I'm still learning things that I know today. Today, I wish I had known yesterday, but you know, that's football, and that's just about anything in life, is that as time goes on and age happens, we start to connect a lot of dots. And so I tell people, I don't think I'm any smarter than anybody else's, but I have had the ability to, there's a saying by Steve Jobs says that you can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them by looking backwards. And that's what I continue to do to evolve myself in football development.
Well, let's talk about this ball mastery subject, because it's a favorite subject of mine. And it's something that in the current group of kids that I sometimes work with leads to horror, because, yep. And I'm going to see if we're on the same page here, ball mastery involves repetition.
Yep.
And repetition for today's youth, boring. Why do I have to do this again and again and again? So talk to me about ball mastery and how you can work within the environment of it, but still have the discipline to do the same thing thousands and thousands of times.
Sure. Well, ball mastery, first of all, is most effective at the youngest, earliest ages. And this is a real big, important point, because there's a lot of arguments going on and discussions about isolated training and unopposed training, doing things repetition-wise over and over and over again. When you start with, and my world, so to speak, is introducing ball mastery to a young child as soon as possible. And I'm talking, you can introduce it as soon as they start walking. And that really kind of makes up the gist of what I'm doing even today currently. And that is focusing on families and moms and dads in particular, because they're the caretakers. They have a much bigger impact on a child's football development than a coach does. And that's not real popular to say, because the conventional wisdom of thinking is that in the traditional sense, to develop top players, everybody believes that that happens, first of all, at the elite level with coaches. But I argue that no, I believe that a lot of the hard work is done in the early stages. So what ball mastery does, for example, for a 2 or 3 year old, and you might say 2 or 3 year old, who? Well, I can actually show you videos of what that actually looks like. And that's really part of the problem, because most don't believe it because they've never seen it. But a 2 or 3 year old developing the ability to control a ball with their feet is really trying to control an object with their feet, which is the ball. That becomes a mental task, okay? So usually what you'll see at the entry level is you go to parks around the world and you'll find parents filled with kids with a big ball and they're just kind of hoofing it back and forth. Well, there's no neural pathway or network that's being built. The feet are the furthest distance from the brain, so we rarely have any opportunities to build these neural pathways. Ball mastery does that. So what happens is when a child is trying to control that object with their feet, okay, basically that's a mental task, but the movement makes it a physical task. So here's a little neuroscience, but it's important to know. When you've got the mind and the body, when you've got thinking and feeling working as one, okay, that allows the part of the brain that's responsible for ball mastery, which is called the cerebellum. It allows the cerebellum to create what we call a chemical signature of the experience, which is emotions. So emotions are the on-off switch for learning. Now, here's a very interesting thing that most coaches don't know. And the reality is that football hasn't caught up to what science knows already. And that is that skill acquisition happens much earlier than everybody supposes it. Okay? But where these technical skills for ball mastery are being deposited in what's called the non-declared memory. This is implicit learning. And for the listeners who don't know, non-declared memory and implicit learning is when you can do something so many times over and over again, and you can't explain why you can do it, and it's effortless. For example, riding a bicycle or driving a car. All of that is basically happening on a subconscious, kind of call it almost like a hard drive, where you don't have to think about it. Now, this is where the argument comes in for the isolated training and the unopposed. And I've only really, to be honest with you, Nick, kind of figured this out of recent. There's a small window. Now, you can never say never. Everybody can always improve. Kids can improve through ball mastery, technical skills, all of that. But understanding the neuroscience, and the reason I understand the neuroscience is because I've been working and collaborating with some of the most brilliant neuroscientists from Harvard Medical School, researchers from Stanford University. We had a 2-year research project at the University of Houston together with the Houston Dynamo, which I directed as well. So I understand now the neuroscience of what's happening. So 95% of a child's brain is developed by the age of 5 or 6. We've got what's called neuroplasticity. That's when the brain can, think of it almost as a sponge, but neuroplasticity is where neural synaptic connections are done. And it's basically, there's a window, a gate that closes or a ceiling that you hit, and it's from those very young ages. So I think what happens is that coaches, let's say they come in contact with the Curver stuff, just because I can't think of any other technical skill specialty program, but they come in contact with that. So, all right, oh, this looks great. Okay, I'm going to go out to training today. I've got 20 kids. I'm going to set up 4 cones. My kids are 12 years old or 13 years old. Set up the 4 cones. You know where I'm going. And you've got the 4 lines, and all the kids are dribbling into the center, doing the scissors, and then they're going out the same direction. Well, that's happening because a child is recalling that movement into their conscious awareness. They know what they're going to do when they run at the cone because it's unopposed. Okay. So But then what's happening is the coaches are seeing that, wow, my kids are getting pretty good at this. They can all step right and they can go left. And okay, and they're so, but they don't see it in the game. They don't see the player executing it in the game. And so now I see, as me being the Curver guy for many years, and I'm not here to promote Curver. I introduced it to Japan here, and I was the face of it for 15 years, but I spun out of it, and I haven't worked with them for as many 15 years. But it's really shaped and formed the way that I think about football development. Now, so if you see me demonstrate, I'm a world-class demonstrator, I'll say that. Why? Because I spent 14 years on national TV every weekday morning, introducing technical skill development. Got the best-selling DVDs in the history of Japan, 5 DVDs, all technical. And I've done over 2,000 events for 500,000 kids. So my demonstrating is the best. But it doesn't mean I'm necessarily going to use all those moves in the game under full pressure. Now, I'm probably better than I was before just because of repetition. But this is the difference between understanding where and how technical skills. So regardless whether it's a mental task or a physical task, it's all stored in the cerebellum. Now, the cerebellum was thought to mainly be responsible for motor skills, balance, and rhythm. But the new neuroscience, through functional MRIs, where they can tell when certain activities happen, what part of the brain lights up, the cerebellum now has been known to, they understand in the neuroscience world, that it's responsible for thinking, for remembering, which is memory, okay, decision-making, controlling emotions, and I say drum roll, reading and single-digit mathematics. So our program, or at least the work that I do now, is much bigger than a football program. It's really, really centered around early child development. And so it comes back to, you know, this ball mastery, right? When you look at the best players in the world, at where they come from, they win what I classify the battle at the entry level. Before a child crosses over the line into organized play, he or she is going to be very competent, very confident. And what's happened is they haven't fallen in love with playing football. They fall in love with the ball. And that all comes through ball mastery. Now, I would imagine that a majority of the kids that aren't having a lot of fun doing the ball mastery and it's like a chore, they've started much later. And so it's not popular to say amongst maybe football people and families in general, but when I talk with neuroscience and early child development, they start to believe that deficits start coming about with young kids at the early ages of 6-7 years of age. So this is a very, very, very small window that happens where these skills can be mastered and deposited into the cerebellum, into the brain, which then can be used in a very unconscious, automated way without having to think about it. So again, this is the reason why for me, my whole center of the world is focused on parents, man. Put me in a room with 500 parents versus 500 coaches of young children, and you will see a massive transformation.
So let me try and get clear, because you said a lot there, and it's going to be tough for me to unpack it all.
Yeah.
But, and I don't want to be the dream killer for anybody out there. But so what you're saying is that after a certain age, regardless of the skills that you are memorizing and repeating, it's not going to help you. It's not going to help you develop into the next level of player.
No. Oh, yeah. Thank you for bringing this up. I'm not saying that directly. What I'm saying is that all players can improve. That's mm-hmm. across the board. And all players will improve, even focusing on ball mastery starting from the older ages. But I don't think you're going to see that giant leap forward that you're expecting. It'll be much more incremental. So it's just like a bicycle, right? I mean, if you take a 5-year-old and try to teach them how to ride a bike versus the, you know, 50-year-old or the 20-year-old or the 30-year-old, it's going to be a much bigger challenge. And
so
never say,
yep,
go ahead.
Okay, so sorry to interrupt.
Okay.
So what we're saying is there'll be incremental improvement. So I guess what I'm asking is, would you be better off refining what you're good at or continue to kind of grind out these incremental improvements in ball mastery?
I would think, I'd say both, to be honest. I mean, one of the problems with technical skill development is that once you start climbing the staircase, so to speak, well, here, this is a good, here's a good one. The reason why the ball mastery at a very, very young age is important is because once a child has developed or built the basic building blocks, okay, of ball mastery, that's when and only when they're going to start experimenting with the more complex, difficult movements. So what happens is the older, so it's called scaffolding. So once you learn basic ball mastery fundamentals, and it's a pity if I could show you, maybe next time offline, we can go through it and I'll show you the presentation. I will show you exactly what it looks like for a 1 or 2 year old and their trajectory of exactly what that looks like in ball mastery, because most people have never seen it. And when you see the really good 6 or 7 year old, most believe that lightning struck in a bottle and this kid was born with it, and nothing could be further than the truth. They haven't seen the silent practice and the silent training that went on. So to answer the question, all players can improve. But again, you know, and never say never. There's always going to be outliers. I didn't start playing really until I was around 10 or 11 years of age, which is, you know, really, really late for a football player, right? But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And I really would have never figured this out unless I had a bit of good luck. I'd written this book called Football Starts Home, and I caught the attention of a Dr. John Rady from Harvard Medical School, who's the foremost neuropsychiatrist in the world. He's written books that have sold millions of copies. And he took an interest in the work that I was doing. And he started seeing the videos of the kids that I was, 2, 3, 4, 5 year old kids. He read the manuscript and he liked it so much. He wrote the foreword and the afterword for the book, 14 pages. And why is that important? Because I'm not an academic. I'm not a scientist. I don't come from the medical community. Do I know a little bit more than the average Joe? Yeah, I probably do, because I'm getting in the room with the smart people and I'm listening and I'm learning. And I was being brought in to learn from, but I'm secretly learning from them. So I understand it better. And now I'm trying to partake that information to coaches and parents as well, because I think it's important. And here's something really, really cool too, is that Dr. Rady had written in the book that he believed that this program of basically ball mastery, especially done at the youngest ages, see, it's the connection between child and parent that brings the magic together. Because a little child is not going to go off into an empty room or in the backyard at 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years old and start practicing ball mastery. It doesn't happen. But the connection between child and parent, and understanding that a child's constant need for a parent's attention, a parent's approval, a parent's praise, that's what creates the magic moment. A parent just being present for their child. And so parents don't understand. So when you look at, again, the countries that develop a lot of great players, you know, it, of course, it's a lot of countries, but in particular, Latin countries, fathers in particular, use football as a tool to bond with their children. So they're constantly, they're getting this. And so people don't understand that head start for a 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 year old, 5 years is massive. Now, never say never, but rarely I've seen it in my career that other kids will catch up to that kid that got the early head start. So if you understand that and you're in a position of leadership or influence in any community, club, country, then you might want to build a strategy that centers around more of educating parents of very young kids. Because one last one, and I'll land the plane here, that is that once a child is competent, comfortable with a ball, before they cross over that line into organized play, 90% of the developmental problems in football cease to become problems. It's almost on autopilot. And there's a bias that manifests in a positive way, because when a six-year-old crosses over the line into organized play and they're very skilled at ball mastery, two things happen. They become very popular on the team. Of course, when the coach says 3 to a ball, 4 to a ball, they'll want to see where the good, hey, where's Nick? I want to go in Nick's group. Okay. And when a coach wants someone to demonstrate, he's going to ask the best kid, oh, where's Mike? I want Mike to demonstrate. So now a little six-year-old is getting the opportunity at leadership of leading 20 more little kids. So I don't think it's a coincidence that both of my boys, 4 years apart, both become their number 10s on their teams, and they both become the captains. And why? Just because they got that head start. Didn't mean they're any better or talented than any other kid. It's just that that early head start is massive in football.
So we, once again, a lot to unpack. You talk about educational, mental, physiological. I'm going to bring it to a player, a Japanese player, very popular in the English Premier League, unfortunately injured right now, Mitoma.
Sure.
One of the most incredible wingers in world football. Yeah. And I read a story about him doing his thesis, his degree on dribbling. And being that you're in the same environment, I wonder, do you have any information on that?
He focused, first of all players here in Japan are strong. When you think or conjure up an image of a Japanese player, the first thing that comes to mind is they're technical, right? They're technical. And not to pat ourselves on the back, but we had a massive influence on this in introducing this whole idea about technical skill development. And he's from this generation. He's from the generation that grew up watching the TV corner that I presented every weekday morning for 14 years. So I know all of these young players that are playing all over Europe and everything. Yeah, he went to a university, which is sports science university. And he wrote his thesis. I haven't seen it. I haven't read it. But I read a thesis on 1v1. But it's not surprising to me because 1v1 is just like the staple here in Japan. I mean, everywhere you look, you'd have to see it. And again, like I said, next time we chat, maybe I can show you. We created what I call a delivery mechanism here in Japan. And that was we wanted to create a movement. And the movement was focused around ball mastery and technical skill development. So how do you supercharge a movement? How do you get that movement out? Well, the way we did it was introduced it through pop culture, which was animation. We introduced it through events, building advocacy all over the country. We built it by creating content, pushing it out over VHS video, DVDs now today, that's apps. We did that by using comic books. We did that by using traditional football magazines, by using television, by just so many different mechanisms. And it all focused on one point. You want to be a good football player, it all starts with the technical component, and it all starts with ball mastery and one versus one. So this isn't a lexicon. This isn't something new. This isn't something, you know, that someone just invented all of a sudden. No, we've got now three decades of this pop culture. When in 1998, I was very lucky. I was casted on Japan's number one television show for children. This is not a football show. This show was born out of the Pokemon craze. Okay. So now I was doing events at the time. So I'm doing an events for 200-400 kids. Now I'm being piped into 5 to 6 million households every day, Monday through Friday. And when I started that corner, I never dreamt it would go 14 years. I did over 3,500 of these appearances. So again, not to pat myself back, it could have maybe been somebody else, but there was just such a barrage of football techniques, as we call them. We've got over 25, 30 football magazines. Every magazine carries a technical corner. All of them do. So we created a bit of an artificial culture because Japan is not a football culture, I can tell you this. But I believe it can be replicated in other countries. It's just that if we can get people to start thinking a little bit differently. But this is the reason why there's such a craze here in Japan, because all of it, at the forefront, at the entry level of the game, is ball mastery. And you'll find it everywhere.
Tom Beyer, the professor of ball mastery. How do listeners of The Bear and the Ball get in touch with you and find out more?
Basically, I mean, I'm pretty active on Twitter. And so my Twitter handle, I guess, as you say, is Tomsan, T-O-M-S-A-N 106. So that's one word, Tomsan 106. And I'm on Twitter and I am probably pretty well known for answering just about anybody who engages with me, good or bad. But most of it, 90% of it's all good. But this is great, really, Nick. I've heard a lot about you and the work that you're doing as well, and now at Cal South. And I would really be interested in furthering our conversation down the road as well, and visiting it as well in person, and seeing if we can try to start this kind of movement in Southern California.
For more on Cal South, please visit calsouth.com, and you can also find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Come back next week for more Bear on the Ball.